From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When filmmaker Tom Joslin and his lover were both sick with AIDS, they videotaped every aspect of their lives. After they died, their videotapes were edited down to a 90-minute documentary that won a prize at the Sundance Film Festival. That film, Silver Lake Life, will be shown tomorrow night on public television. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Friedman, the editor of the film, who was a close friend and former student of Tom Joslin. Also today, musical Americana, interpreted by guitarist Bill Frisell. He'll tell us why he's recorded works by Copeland, Ives, Dylan, Sousa, Rollins, and Madonna. And we remember actor Ray Sharkey, who died on Friday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Supreme Court nominee Ruth Bader Ginsburg received bipartisan praise from Senate leaders today. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Judge Ginsburg has been the focus of Senate scrutiny before. She was approved by the Judiciary Committee 13 years ago when she was first nominated to the Court of Appeals. Utah Republican Orrin Hatch supported Ginsburg then and said he will do so again. He said he has some ideological differences with the judge, but they aren't relevant.
If the nominee of the president is competent, intelligent, honest, basically sound, and has good health, and a good reputation, I suspect that those are the major factors we have to consider.
Arizona Democrat Dennis DeConcini said he foresees no problems with Judge Ginsburg's nomination.
And I just think this is a clean, clean appointment and should receive. I'd be surprised if anybody's against her.
The senator said they hope confirmation hearings can be held before the Senate's August recess. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
At least 12 Somalis were wounded today when an American Cobra helicopter attacked a rocket launcher site in Mogadishu. The raid was the first daylight attack by UN forces after three straight nights of bombing and strafing at positions connected to faction leader Mohamed Farah Aidid. The UN said the helicopter attack was aimed at a rocket launcher inside a Somali faction compound. Local residents and reporters who saw the rocket launcher said it was a rusted wreck that had been sitting unused for months. Local witnesses also claimed that the helicopter fired a second rocket that went astray and killed a civilian woman at a tea shop. The UN insisted that the helicopter fired only one round, although reporters at the scene said two explosions were clearly heard. The situation in the Bosnian Muslim enclave of Garajda is said to be worsening. Garajda is one of the towns designated as safe zones by the United Nations. The BBC's Jim Muir reports from Sarajevo.
Latest reports from inside Garajda say the Bosnian Serb forces besieging the town have stepped up their heavy rocket and artillery barrages while pressing in on all sides. The situation in the enclave, where an estimated 60,000 people, most of them Muslims, are believed to be trapped, is said to be increasingly desperate. One report sent out by a radio link said that the makeshift hospitals had hardly anything left with which to treat the constant stream of casualties, including many children. Another report said that up to 2,000 people may have died since the Bosnian Serb offensive began 3 weeks ago. Garajda is supposed to be one of the safe areas designated by the United Nations. But so far, the UN has been unable even to position observers there.
Jim Muir for the BBC. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 10 points to close at 3,514. This is NPR News. Today, the United Nations recommended sending 7,500 more troops to Bosnia to protect the six Muslim areas designated as UN safe havens. The recommendation came at the same time as a UN report saying it would take about 34,000 troops to do the job right. At the moment, the UN has about 9,000 troops on the ground in Bosnia. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said that 7,500 troops is the number that could be reasonably expected on a rapid deployment basis. More than 1,000 union workers at a Frigidaire plant in Webster, Iowa, are on strike today. Lisa Phillips of member station KTPR reports.
Members of the United Auto Workers Local 442 rejected a tentative contract agreement by a 76% margin yesterday. Today, none of the 1,150 Frigidaire Laundry Division plant employees showed up for work. A statement issued by the union says workers objected to the proposed agreement's health insurance and seniority provisions. The scene of the strike today is calm, with about a dozen workers at a time taking four-hour shifts on the picket line in front of the North Central Iowa plant. A meeting between union negotiators and company officials is scheduled for tomorrow to discuss the strikers' concerns. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Phillips in Fort Dodge, Iowa.
Conservative Party leader Kim Campbell will be sworn in as Canada's first female prime minister on June 25th. Campbell, a 46-year-old lawyer from Vancouver, won the party's leadership yesterday. She replaces Brian Mulroney, who announced his resignation after 9 years in office and a plunge in popularity. Under Canada's parliamentary system, Campbell must call elections by fall. The leader of Canada's Liberal Party said that Campbell's leadership is only a summer job and that she'll be ousted soon. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When a character you love dies in a feature film, you can reassure yourself that it's only a movie. But when Tom Joslin dies in the new film Silver Lake Life, you're defenseless. Joslin was a filmmaker and teacher. Silver Lake Life is his video journal of the last chapter of his life after he was diagnosed with AIDS. He often turned the camera on his lover of 22 years, Mark Massey, who also had AIDS. When Tom got too sick to set up the camera, Mark took over. He even filmed Tom's death in 1990. After Mark died several months later, the videotapes were inherited by Peter Friedman, a close friend and former student of Tom's. Friedman edited down the 40 hours of videotape to a 90-minute documentary. It won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Tomorrow night, you can see it on Public TV's POV series. I asked Peter Friedman to describe the range of material in the raw tape he received.
It was primarily a diary of daily life, so there were a lot of, and it was shot with a camcorder, a kind of high-end version of a home video camera. And so it was something that was easy to film. It didn't require a lot of setup. And for someone who's sick, nothing's easy. Just opening the case and taking out this little camera was sometimes too much for Tom to do because, I mean, there were days when he couldn't even get out of bed. But relatively speaking, it was easy enough to do so that he could take it into all kinds of situations and film in a very spontaneous way. So whenever, he might film themselves going out to dinner at a local restaurant, or he might teaching his class at USC, its film class, or these are some of the things that did not make it into the final tape. But also there were the trips to the doctor, and there were the kind of intimate moments around the house, and there were the views of the neighborhood, and there was a trip back home to visit the family, and there was also other film work that Tom had done that he left behind that was provided source material for me ultimately.
I want to ask you about some of the scenes that you decided to include after reviewing about 40 hours of video. There's a scene, and this comes early on in the film, of Mark and Tom just lying in bed talking. They're talking to the camera, which is, set up in the room, and they're looking at each other on the video monitor. And Tom notices, through looking at the monitor, that there's a new lesion on Mark's eyelid.
Right.
It's a really interesting scene. Can you tell me why you chose to include that one?
Well, I chose to include that for a number of reasons, one of which was the fact that because very often Mark was filming Tom or Tom was filming Mark, there are very few scenes in which they were both on camera together.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tom had this camera set up by his bedside and Mark had come and lay down beside him. And so the moment expressed their ease with each other, their ease with the camera, the way in which their situation being, people with AIDS was part of their life, but not all of their life. So to me, it expressed their intimacy, their ease, their camera consciousness, and the fact that they were people with AIDS and dealing with that too, all in a half a minute.
There's a really nice moment in the film where Mark is kissing Tom goodnight, and Tom says something like, looking into the camera, says, "I bet you people don't get great kisses like this," something along those lines. It's
right.
A really nice moment. As intimate as the film gets, what isn't in there is anything more sexual than that. Now, I was just wondering if they ever went that far with the camera.
Yes, they did, but not in the course of Silver Lake life. I mean, Tom had been making personal films and using his life and his life with Mark as the stuff of his work off and on throughout the time I knew him, which was 15 years. So back in the 70s, there's a scene in Black Star, which is the film that's excerpted in Silver Lake Life, of Mark and Tom in bed together. And it's sort of staged a little bit as a comic scene because they're surrounded by piles and piles of film. And they're having a discussion in bed about how film always comes between them and Tom's filmmaking. It was very kind of 70s self-conscious film style. Tom turns toward the camera in the middle of it and says, "I hate this stuff in cinema verite," you know. And so, you know, in the same way he turned toward the camera and made a little joke in that scene in Silver Lake Life, he was very comfortable with the camera, and he was very sort of he had a kind of quality of being a kind of natural kind of entertainer, sort of a persona that he had kind of cultivated.
When Tom got too sick to keep filming, Mark took over as the cameraman. How do you think that the tone changes when Mark takes over?
Well, I think that Mark's focus was more on Tom, and Tom included himself in his focus, but it was the focus of the film went from Tom kind of looking at his life and the world around him to Mark kind of looking at Tom. And so the world was shrinking in the way that, you know, when people become sicker and their capacities, their physical capacities become more limited, their world shrinks in a sense because their ability to go out into the world is diminished. So Mark really saw himself as kind of doing for Tom what Tom couldn't do for himself, as much as kind of expressing his point of view about it. He was keeping the film going in the same way that he was doing many other things to keep daily life going. The filmmaking was part of daily life, and it was something that needed to be continued in the same way that many other things needed to be continued to get through the day.
There's an incredibly moving moment. I mean, I don't think I could do justice to how moving it is when Mark is videotaping Tom just after Tom died. Tom's body is in bed. Mark is weeping off camera, describing Tom's death. And he says to Tom, "You're so beautiful." And, you know, you're watching this movie and you're thinking, yes, he really is. He really is beautiful. And what you're seeing is just the shell of a person. I mean, I'm sure he looks like a Holocaust victim. I mean, he's just skeletal. His face is deformed by the lesions from the Kaposi's. And you look at him, you say, yeah, he's really, really beautiful. What was your reaction when you saw that? And you must have had these kind of like personal reaction and then filmmaker reaction all at the same time.
I thought that was one of the most, if not the most powerful, moving moments I'd ever seen on film or video in my life. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't able to tell how much I was affected, how much that was just because it was someone I knew and loved. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that other people would react that way at the time. But I do think, you know, as you say, you said to yourself, yes, he is beautiful. And that's because you saw in him in that moment not only the physical deformities that had ravaged him, but the person you had come to know in the previous hour of the film.
That's exactly right. I mean, honestly, when you watch the movie, you really feel like they're your friends because you've gotten to know them so well because they've showed you so much about themselves.
Well, they were my friends, and they, and as I think I mentioned, I have many other friends who are sick or who have died, and so that experience is so difficult and so prevalent and so important that one of the purposes of the film is to for people who maybe haven't had that experience to know a little bit about what it feels like, you know, at least those people who are willing to accept the challenge of going through it. And of course there are many, many people out there who have been through it and who are going through it all the time, and for those people, it was I think Tom's wish and certainly mine to make a document which was true and faithful to the essence of, or part of the essence of what that experience is about.
Some people would think that some things are just too personal to be filmed and shown to the public, and that one of those things would be a film of somebody at the moment of death and thereafter. Did you have any reservations at all about putting that part into the movie?
None whatsoever, because for a number of reasons. One is that those images around Tom's death were filmed by Mark, and it was the most tragic moment of his life until that time, and yet he saw fit to put it on camera, and he would not have done so if he didn't think Tom's thought it fit. So there was no voyeurism or exploitation, because there was no distance between the filmmaker and the person having the experience. You know, I mean, it was all a very intimate act.
My guest is Peter Friedman, editor of the new film Silver Lake Life, a video journal of Tom Joslin and his lover Mark Massey in the last part of their lives before they died of AIDS. It will be shown tomorrow night on the public television series POV. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Peter Friedman, edited the new film Silver Lake Life. You shot some footage of Mark after Tom died.
Right.
How much of Mark's story did you consider telling for the film? How much did you want to, like, follow his story after?
Well, even when I shot that interview with Mark, I wasn't entirely sure that it was going to be combined with the footage of Silver Lake Life.
Mm-hmm.
Or that I was going to end up with Silver Lake Life, or, I mean, you know, it's hard to describe how uncertain things were and how they kind of happened just the way they happened and not according to anybody's plan, really. So in retrospect, I like to think that, you know, Silver Lake Life was at its core Tom Joslin's personal story told from his point of view, and the film exists because he decided to make it and expressed his vision and exercised his will and his ability. And so the lack of a storyteller to tell the story of what happened to Mark after Tom was gone reflects the loss of Tom. Tom was the primary storyteller, and he wasn't there to tell the story.
There's excerpts in Silver Lake of an earlier documentary that Tom made, another personal documentary about being gay, and he interviews his parents for that earlier film, and you could tell they're really uncomfortable with him being gay. I mean, his father particularly just can't deal with Tom's lover, Mark. And that film was shown on some PBS stations.
Right.
Years ago. How did Tom's parents react to this new film, which is about to be shown on many PBS stations?
Tom's parents were shown the film a couple of months ago by Tom's brother, Whitey. And Tom's mother asked Whitey to call the newspaper where they live in New Hampshire and invited a journalist over, and the result was a big two-page article in the New Hampshire newspaper, because she wanted to let her extended family who lived around the state know that this had happened. And her attitude was, it was really, I mean, for something for which I am profoundly grateful that she reacted the way that she did, which was that she was extremely happy that her son's dream was being realized, and also expressed hope that that it would help somehow, that it would help other people who are going through this, or it would help educate people to prevent them from having to go through this. Or so, you know, even back in 76, when they were expressing their discomfort on camera in Black Star, they had still agreed to be on camera to express their discomfort. So there was a kind of implicit acceptance of what was going on, or at least a willingness to help Tom do what he wanted to do, even if they didn't entirely understand everything he did.
I couldn't help wondering, watching the movie, if you had lost a lover to AIDS.
I lost a very close friend of mine a month ago who had at one time been a lover, I have not been through it in the way that Mark and Tom were, in terms of somebody I'd live with for a long time or anything like that. No, but I have lost a number of people who are very, very close to me. It's not the same thing, but AIDS has certainly been a constant and massive presence in my personal daily life since the mid-'80s, without any period since then where there wasn't somebody in my life who was sick.
What importance did Tom have in your life as a friend and as a teacher?
Tom was probably one of the most important people in my life, period, particularly since I met him when I was barely 18 years old. It was my first year of college. I didn't know who I was or what I wanted to be, and I was also a deeply closeted young man struggling with my own sexuality and struggling to deny my homosexuality. And so Tom was somebody who, I mean, I saw Black Star my first semester of school, and it was the first time I had ever been exposed to any kind of open discussion of homosexuality, much less on the screen.
That's the film that he made about himself, the first film he made.
Yes, the ones that I used excerpts from in Silver Lake Life, yeah. And so it was just an incredibly important experience for me as a young gay man growing up, you know, with no role models and no real knowledge that it was possible to live a healthy, happy life as a gay man, is it possible to be open and honest about who you were and build your life around that, to have somebody come along who represented that possibility. And gay people so often are denied that, as we're denied so many other things that heterosexuals are so accustomed to that they don't even know they have. And so that was a profound experience for me. And Tom, I didn't go to college knowing I wanted to get into film. Tom was just somebody who I really wanted to be around as much as I could, to sort of, he sort of represented to me someone who had found some answers about life that I wanted to find. And so I hung around him. I took his classes. I became his assistant on his film projects. And I gradually got to know Mark and became close friends with him too. And I guess because of the period of time I met him, which was I was 18, it was just a tremendously important experience for me. So there's no question in my mind that I got into film because of him, and that I was able to develop an identity as a self-accepting, healthy, openly gay person as a result of Mark and Tom's example.
When you were editing the film of the last part of Tom's life, did you hear Tom's voice in your head kind of giving you advice about what to use or what not use? Did you feel guided by him at all?
No. See, that's one of the things that I spent 2 months looking at the footage and trying to evaluate what kind of a film there might be in there. And that was one of the things I had to get over in order to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I inherited was like an archive of the last year of their lives. It wasn't a rough cut. There wasn't a script. It was just, there was a million directions it could have gone in, and it wasn't self-evident what kind of film there was in there. And so the film was difficult enough, but if I had constantly been wondering what would he have done here, what would he have done here, especially since he was my mentor and somebody who kind of loomed large in my personal history and esteem, I would have been paralyzed. So I had to sort of accept the fact that he was gone, that this was an unfinished project, that I had to really kind of dig in and just take charge of it and do what I wanted to do. So in a sense, I kind of had a put a sign on the door of the editing room that said, no ghosts allowed.
Peter Friedman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Friedman edited the film Silver Lake Life. It will be shown tomorrow night on the public TV series POV. You can find a used bookstore in almost any resort town. Usually they're slightly seedy places that stay in business by peddling the moldy bestsellers of summers past to vacationers searching for a good read. But commentator Maureen Corrigan says that some of these bookstores contain more than just the collected works of Herman Walk, and if you don't mind getting a little dirty, you might just unearth some buried mystery treasures.
For a week every summer, I share a house down the Jersey Shore with a bunch of old friends. Along with lots of gossip and sunblock, we all bring something else on vacation, a beach book. One book usually lasts the week, but a few years ago, it rained for a record 6 days. There was nothing to do but eat potato chips, get on each other's nerves, and read. And so every day, some of us would wade over to the nearby used book shack and search for good mysteries. That shack was thick with the odor of stale copper tone and dust and decomposing Danielle Steele novels, but it also contained a few masterpieces. Like an out-of-print novel entitled Beyond a Reasonable Doubt by C.W. Grafton. That's right, Sue Grafton, who writes the best-selling Kinsey Milhone series, owes at least some of her talent to heredity. Her father, C.W., wrote this high-anxiety classic around 1950, and it was last reprinted about 15 years ago. It's a film noirish kind of story about a nice young lawyer who commits murder and then decides to defend himself. I haven't read John Grisham's legal thrillers yet, but I have read Scott Turow's, and believe me, Grafton's courtroom scenes are so spine-tingling, they make Turow's read like the transcripts from a whiplash trial. Celia Fremlin's English mystery, The Hours Before Dawn, may remind you of that backlash movie hit of last summer, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. But in this 1958 mother versus murderer face-off, the gender politics are more enlightened. The Hours Before Dawn presents one of the most sympathetic, least romanticized depictions of motherhood that I've ever read. Poor, exhausted Louise Henderson has a newborn son who cries every night. As Fremlin writes, Louise is so sleep-deprived that she's pushed over some invisible frontier where everything takes on the quality of a dream. In her receptive, half-conscious state, Louise begins to sense that someone evil is watching her. Is it just her imagination? Or is it that new boarder, schoolteacher Vera Brandon? The Hours Before Dawn is in print, though it's hard to find. The salt-encrusted first edition I stumbled upon has a cover blurb from the Yorkshire Post that praises the book as very funny and unusually menacing. I'd second that emotion. Even though The Vanished Child was just published last year, it's already on remainder shelves. This novel is set in 1906, and the beautiful hardcover edition looks like it was printed back then. Author Sarah Smith does a finely tuned imitation of Edith Wharton in her spookier moments. This story concerns a double murder, a missing child, and the legacy of madness. The Vanished Child is scheduled to come out this fall in paperback, if you can wait that long. For those of you whose dust allergies keep you from prowling used bookstores, here's a fresh mystery tip. Anna's book by Ruth Rendell, writing as Barbara Vine. It's due in bookstores any minute now. The greatest compliment a reviewer can pay a book is to say, "It was so good, I stopped taking notes." Anna's book was so good, I never started. Here's hoping for rain on your vacation.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why is avant-garde guitarist Bill Frisell performing the music of Aaron Copland, Bob Dylan, John Philip Sousa, and Madonna? And why did he choose an accordion player, clarinetist, and drummer to perform with him? Coming up, we talk with Frisell about his new album of Americana. And we remember actor Ray Sharkey with an excerpt from a 1988 interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton nominated Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court today. White House officials described a meeting the president held with Ginsburg yesterday as pivotal to his decision. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
After weeks of speculation and the review of over 3,000 opinions by a team of 75 lawyers, the choice came down to Judge Ginsburg and Judge Stephen Breyer of Boston. Senior White House officials say the president passed over Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt after confrontations with members of Congress at a White House picnic and dozens of calls demanding that he be kept at his post. President Clinton met with Ginsburg yesterday for an hour and a half. He told his staff the meeting was quite moving, that he was impressed by her commitment to family and her strong sense that decisions made by the court affect people's lives. From the outset, the president had asked his staff to cast a wide net for people who were not necessarily judges, people with vast public experience. He was also seeking someone who could bring the court together. In the end, senior officials say, it was not her decisions, but her judicial philosophy and strength of character that tipped the balance in her favor. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The Ginsburg nomination won praise today on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, but some conservative senators said they'd scrutinize the judge's record before voting on her confirmation. The senior Republican on the Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch, said Ginsburg will make an excellent justice. Another Republican committee member, William Cohen, said he expects an overwhelming, if not unanimous, vote. And Committee Chair Joseph Biden praised what he called Ginsburg's impressive record. While Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey underwent heart and liver transplant operations today, hundreds of people called the Center for Organ Recovery and Education in Pittsburgh asking how Governor Casey got the organs so quickly. Christina Senko of member station WDUQ reports.
Brian Brosnick, executive director of the Center for Organ Recovery and Education, says Governor Casey did not receive preferential treatment. It was just luck that a donor that matched Casey's needs was found within 24 hours of him being placed on the list.
There were patients who would have been ahead of him, six patients actually, who would have been ahead of him if he did not need to combine transplant.
Brosnick says because Casey needed a multiple organ transplant, he was moved up on the list, as are all people in need of more than one organ. For National Public Radio, I'm Christina Senko in Pittsburgh.
In Somalia, Mogadishu warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid accused the United Nations of genocide today. He said he'll talk with the UN only after it stops bombing what he claimed are civilian facilities. The UN launched a third airstrike today on suspected ammunition dumps belonging to Aidid. Residents say nine Somalis were killed in the attack. Hospital sources confirm one dead. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 9.68 points. This is NPR. Cambodia's new assembly made Prince Norodom Sihanouk head of state today. Sihanouk urged the assembly to restrain a rebellion by leaders of the former ruling party. They lost Cambodia's recent elections and have declared an autonomous zone in eastern Cambodia. The secession movement is led by one of Sihanouk's sons, Prince Norodom Chakrapong. The Phun Sin Pek party, which won the elections, is preparing to fight the rebels. Phun Sin Pek's leader is also a son of Sihanouk, Prince Norodom Ranarid. In Nigeria, partial returns are coming in from this weekend's presidential elections, and one candidate appears headed for victory. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Billionaire businessman Masud Abiola is being projected as the winner of Nigeria's presidential elections. Returns from about a third of Nigeria's 30 provinces give Abiola a 2-to-1 edge over challenger Bashir Tofa. Final results in Africa's most populous nation are expected to be announced tomorrow. Abiola, 55, would become Nigeria's first civilian head of state in 9 years. In 1984, a military coup toppled the corrupt and ineffective government of twice-elected President Shehu Shagari. Since then, Nigeria's military government has promised to restore democracy. However, current President Ibrahim Babangida has been harshly criticized for his handling of the democratic transition, including the creation of Nigeria's only two legal parties. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
President Clinton has named a panel to find new ways of bolstering economic growth without damaging the environment. The 24-member panel is called the Council on Sustainable Development. It includes business leaders, government officials, environmentalists, and civil rights groups. The Food and Drug Administration plans to release new rules tomorrow for dietary supplements. The FDA says companies claiming their products improve health will have to prove it. Companies that make dietary supplements are reportedly furious. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bill Frisell has been called a genius of the guitar by composer John Zorn. Many musicians and listeners agree. Frisell studied with one of the most subtle guitarists in jazz, Jim Hall. But Frisell's own playing ranges from subtle lyricism to raucous, noisy distortion. Before he became a guitar player, Frisell played clarinet. His latest album is called Have a Little Faith, but I think of it as Bill Frisell's Americana. It features a wide range of composers and songwriters he loves, including Aaron Copland, Charles Ives, Muddy Waters, Bob Dylan, Sonny Rollins, and Madonna. He's put together a wonderful but unconventional grouping of musicians to interpret the music. Don Byron is on clarinet, Guy Klusevic on accordion, Kermit Driscoll on bass, Joey Barron on drums. This is their interpretation of Street Scene in a Frontier Town from Copland's Billy the Kid. Music from Bill Frisell's new album, Have a Little Faith. He also does a version of John Philip Sousa's Washington Post March, a staple of marching bands. I asked him why he chose the march.
That was one of the first pieces of music that I ever played in this marching band when I was 10 years old. I must have played that thing 1,000 times. I don't know. So that's one of my earliest musical memories. But the first time I ever played in public was in Denver, where I grew up. I played in this marching band, and we played for the stock show parade in January. It was about 10 degrees outside. I couldn't play a note because my fingers were frozen to my clarinet, and we had kind of a strict band director who insisted that we had to stay completely in a straight line. So like I said, this is a stock show, right? He said, you got to just march no matter what comes up in front of you. You can't break your stride. So anyway, I didn't play a note, but I kept my line straight and my feet got a little dirty.
It's really fun to hear a march without any brass in it. Actually, none of these instruments, except for the clarinet and maybe the drums, are associated with marches. Certainly not the accordion, certainly not the electric guitar bass. Did you have fun arranging this march for instruments not associated with marches?
Oh, yeah. I always had this fantasy about just taking the, if I could take my electric guitar and go play with a... you know, just play all over the top of a marching band or something. That's sort of what it is, I guess.
There's a fun and irony on your version of this Sousa March that I'm sure you weren't encouraged to express when you were in the marching band.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. That was, like I said, I always had this urge to kind of just mess with it a little bit or not quite destroy it, but just...
Well, get out of the regimentation.
Yeah.
My guest is guitarist Bill Frisell. He has a new album called Have a Little Faith. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is guitarist Bill Frisell. Now let me go to your version of Bob Dylan's Just Like a Woman. This isn't a song most people think of as lending itself to an instrumental rendition. I mean, even if you don't understand what the lyrics mean, you usually think of it as a song that somebody sings.
Uh-huh.
What inspired you to arrange Just Like a Woman?
Well, Bob Dylan is another one of these just, for me, like a giant. People talk about his, usually they talk about the words and what a great, they talk of him as a poet, or for me, I love the way he sings and I love the way he plays guitar. He's a great musician.
So this is another example of something that you knew earlier in your life coming back to you now.
Yeah. And it, one thing I love to do on the guitar is to use the guitar as a voice, or, you know, hear the words and hear his voice in my head as I'm playing the melody. I mean, I can't sing. I have enough trouble talking, let alone singing. And the guitar is sort of my way of expressing that. I just love to do that. Take a song and try to sort of match what a singer would do with it.
Thank you. But I love the sound that you get from your guitar. There's something very spacious and very reflective in a way with your sound. I'm sure some of our listeners are wondering how much of your sound is from gizmos and how much of it is just from your touch.
I mean, I definitely use some gizmos, but not that much. I mean, I have a pretty simple setup. I use a volume pedal, which is really important. It sort of allows me to simulate the breath. Like all those years playing the clarinet, playing the guitar, I missed that, the ability to have the breath going into the instrument. So with a volume pedal, I can kind of simulate the up and down dynamics that you would get with your lungs, you know.
So you played clarinet for how many years before switching over to guitar?
Well, I think I was 9 or 10, however old you are when you're in fourth grade. That's when I started clarinet and played it into my second year of college. So it's however long, that's quite a while. But fairly soon after that, I started to play the guitar. 2 or 3 years later, I saved up my money and got an electric guitar. And
this was 2 or 3 years after you started playing clarinet?
Yeah. The guitar sort of goes back even earlier than that. I remember when I was like 4 or 5 years old, and every day I would watch the Mickey Mouse Club on TV, and I couldn't wait for the part where, I think his name was Jimmy, the kind of the leader of the Mouseketeers, would come out with his guitar and sing to the kids, you know, and I really just loved looking at his guitar. And so around that time I made my own, I cut out the shape out of a piece of cardboard and put rubber bands on it. And so that was like, I was 4 or 5 years old. I was already thinking about it a little bit.
Boy, that's great that your first influence was Jimmy from the Mouseketeers instead of Elvis. Guitar must have opened up very different social aspects of the music than the clarinet did, because you could probably play at dances and you'd have more friends that you could be in bands with.
Right. Well, that was what made me start in the first place, was just, it was a social thing. You know, my friend across the street got a guitar, so I wanted to get a guitar. And then almost as soon as I got an electric guitar, you know, I could barely play 2 chords, but just the fact that you owned the instrument, you could play in a band.
You know, you've talked about how some of the music on this new record is music that you first heard when you were young and that you appreciate more now than you did then. I'm actually wondering if some of this music is music you wouldn't have been comfortable admitting you liked a few years ago when you were younger.
That's true. That's what I've been finding. It seems like as I get older, part of the process is being able to not be afraid to just acknowledge where I'm coming from and not worry so much about what's cool or hip or what's in fashion or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wouldn't have been that long ago that to admit that I liked Sousa March or Bob Dylan or whatever, that would have been, especially in sort of, if you're in a real jazz world, that sometimes that doesn't fit in well at all.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Guitarist Bill Frisell, his new album, Have a Little Faith, is on Elektra Nonesuch. This is his version of Madonna's Live to Tell.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air.
President Clinton has nominated Ruth Ginsburg to the Supreme Court. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what are you going to have on that, on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg about Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how the president came about to make this decision. Just a couple of days ago, it seemed he was leaning toward Judge Stephen Breyer, the appeals judge from Boston. Also, we'll be hearing from a judge in California about why it's important, in his view, that there should be a Jewish justice on the Supreme Court. Judge Ginsburg is Jewish. Also, do you remember the old TV show You Are There?
Yeah.
Remember Walter Cronkite used to introduce it? CBS correspondents would report on the death of Socrates and stories like that. We'll hear from the people who really wrote it at the beginning today. They were blacklisted writers writing through fronts.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Actor Ray Sharkey died on Friday of AIDS. He was 40. Many people became his fans after seeing him on the TV series Wise Guy in the role of gangster Sonny Steelgrave. He gave a great performance in the film The Idolmaker as a producer who created teen idols. And he co-starred in the comedy Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. Sharkey's career was held back by drug problems, and he's said to have contracted AIDS from IV drug use. We're going to remember him with an excerpt of a 1988 interview during a period when he seemed to have given up drugs and alcohol. We spoke shortly after his Wise Guy success. Let's hear a scene from his last Wise Guy episode when he found out his right-hand man, Vinny, was really an undercover agent for the FBI. In the character's last moments, he plays the jukebox and sings along with the Rascals' Good Lovin'.
I was feeling so bad. I asked my family doctor just what I had. I said, doctor, Mr. MD, can you tell me what's ailing me? He said, yeah. Randolph Scott was shooting his way through Tombstone while I was working my way through Maria's wire-reinforced underwear. Ooh, I can still feel it. Come on, love. All I need is love. Give me good loving, Maria. Yeah!
Gangster and mobster performances are really good performances. Are so much fun to watch, and I'm always trying to figure out why are great performances in gangster roles and mafia roles so terrific. Do you have any ideas? I mean, I really enjoyed watching you in that role.
Well, think about it. They're enjoyable to watch because there's a sense of danger. These characters just run through social morality and rules and regulations, and they break them, and they speak what's on their mind. They do things that we all wish we could do.
Yeah, I think it's the energy in the performance. I think it's the energy, and also that a lot of mobsters are also terrific actors, and that's part of their gift. So maybe that's a great opportunity for an actor to play someone who's really aware of his own mannerisms.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, you're probably right, but the bottom line to that is the terrific actors in this generation who are playing mobsters in terrific parts, it's got to come easy to them because they're from New York. And
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, you're Italian-born from New York, right?
Irish-Italian kid from Red Hook, South Brooklyn.
And you have a pretty strong New York accent still.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you started acting, did you think, and has it, in fact, affected the kind of roles that you can get? Can you lose the accent if you want to?
Yeah. When I started acting, I was taught that an actor was an actor. You played every part that you can. So, obviously, we were trained for 4 years in the classics, and you had all these, and at that time I was 17, right out of the streets of Brooklyn, and I was going... this too solid flesh should melt and sever into a dew. You know, I mean, the school I came from was you approached it from in the internal part of the person you were playing. And if you had that thing happening inside you, then you could play the part. The rest you learned. And I'm glad that was the foundation I had as an actor, because now you could play almost anything.
Your role in Wise Guy was something of a comeback for you. You were out of acting for a while. Could you explain what had happened during that hiatus?
Actually, I wasn't. That's very nice of you to put it that way. But I was still acting. Only I was taking like parts that were very obscure because I was hoping people wouldn't see me, and I can just make the money and take the money and party with it. I was having what I thought was a good time. I was just traveling around the country, using drugs and drinking, and I thought I was having a good time.
Was there a period when you were thinking that this wasn't affecting your acting at all?
Definitely. Most definitely. I mean, I thought it was making it better. I didn't do it while I was actually acting. I would do it, like, afterwards at night. And then that sort of, in the last year of my abuse, it sort of, like, leaked into, sneaking into the bathroom at the trailer and having the ADs wait for me and telling them that I was taking a large dump. And then it started to get in the way of my work. It was time to get it together.
You know, one of the really nice things I always feel about acting and writing is that whatever happens to you, you can eventually use it in some way. There's something you can learn from it and either write about or put in a performance. Were you able to feel that way even when you were kind of down, that, like, eventually I can use this?
Yeah, the trick is to be able to get in touch with it, which takes a while, because after all the years of abusing your body and your mind, you tend to burn out, so you don't remember a lot of feelings. You don't know how to get in touch with your feelings and what's happening inside yourself. But as long as you stay clean for a length of time, it will come back, and then you'll be able to use it. But the most important thing that happened in my work from not using drugs or drinking anymore was that I'm able these days to remain honest as an actor. Whatever emotions come up, I'm able to put them in my eyes, in my face, and in my heart immediately. And that's honest work. And that's what you see I think that's what you saw when you saw Sonny.
Actor Ray Sharkey, he died Friday at the age of 40. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Reporter Molly Moore says she witnessed the fiercest and most chaotic 100 hours of the Persian Gulf War. But because of the communications problems, few of her stories made it to her paper, The Washington Post. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with her about her new book, A Woman at War, Storming Kuwait with the U.S. Marines. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.